In the year 2525, if man is still alive, if woman can survive, they may find. In the year 3535, ain't gonna need to tell the truth, tell no lies. Everything you think, do, and say is in the pill you took today. In the year 4545, ain't gonna need your teeth, won't need your eyes. You won't find a thing to chew, nobody's gonna look at you. In the year 5555, your arms are hanging limp at your sides. Your legs got nothing to do, some machine doing that for you. In the year 6565, ain't gonna need no husband, won't need no wife. You pick your son, pick your daughter too, from the bottom of a long glass tube. Whoa, whoa. In the year 7510, if God's a-coming, he ought to make it by then. Maybe he'll look around himself and say, guess it's time for the judgment day. In the year 8510, God is gonna shake his mighty head. He'll either say, I'm pleased where man has been, or tear it down and start again. Whoa, whoa. In the year 95-95, I'm kinda wondering if man is gonna be alive. He's taken everything this old earth can give, and he ain't put back nothing. Whoa, whoa. Now it's been 10,000 years, man has cried a billion tears for what he never knew. Now man's reign is through, but through eternal night, the twinkling of starlight, so very far away, maybe it's only yesterday. In the year 2525, if man is still alive, if woman can survive, they may.
That was In the Year 2525 by Zager and Evans, which I remember as being a hit round about the autumn of 1969 when I was 16. And it always was a bit of a funny track. They were a couple of weird-looking hippie guys who appeared on Top of the Pops, but they looked a little bit too old. They looked like they were country guys or old chancers or something. They'd been at it for ages, and there is something very strangely God-bothered about the track. It's a basic Christian precept and fundamentalist thing that, well, if we don't get our act together, there's only misery and fear to come. It's not going to be very nice, and the further we get into the future, the worse it'll be. And even if God doesn't come, you know, to put an end to all our abject misery, things are just going to be worse. So it's a pretty miserable sort of song. And then it's got these strangely incongruous Mexicali trumpets on there, you know. And a couple of old country singers, Christians, you know, masquerading as hippies. I seem to remember they wore fringes and tassels in that peculiar 1969 post-Woodstockian look. That was a very strange time for me, because I was working as a messenger boy in EC3 down Lloyd's Avenue. And King Crimson had just brought their first LP out. And I remember there was a kind of disco in the pub where all the office workers used to go and let their hair down. And seeing office workers let their hair down, you know, you'll get one of them will, sooner or later, will take off his tie and tie it round his head and decide that, in spite of the fact that he looks completely stupid, he's Mick Jagger now. And that is just one of the most cringe-making things you can see. And one of the things I remember with this track is a couple came in from another office. No one from our office knew them. And they did that thing that I once saw in The Office, where a rather suave-looking office manager and one of the office girls went into an actual choreographed dance routine. That happened to this track, so I can really remember Zager and Evans, but I don't remember it as being a particularly good time. Not for pop, because there was all the good stuff was underground, which Radio 1, of course, were resolutely refusing to play. And anything that was good, like A Whole Lot of Love, which came out around about the same time, Led Zeppelin just refused to do Top of the Pops, which everyone kind of went, yes, they've refused to do the great Top of the Pops. So Top of the Pops retaliated by getting a kind of orchestral version of Whole Lot of Love and using that as the theme for years afterwards. I think it was just a lucky hit. They did this record and they came out of nowhere. I don't think they belonged to any particular music movement. I don't know anything about their history at all. They were one of those one-hit wonders, but I do remember that the song was number one for about 6 weeks. It seemed to be there forever. It's one of those things like Bridge Over Troubled Water. You're pig sick of it, you know. It came up on the radio, you just thought, oh, no.
Because presumably in the year 2525, they'll probably play it again, won't they?
If we ever get... it's a long way away, you know. If God is coming, he'll have made it by then, I reckon. As they so rightly said all those years ago. That very same autumn was A Space Oddity. It was roughly the same chart. I think Zager and Evans were a little bit earlier. He wasn't number one, David Bowie. Not that time. I think I don't seem to remember he was. He was number one in 1975 when it was re-released. Stylophones were very what was it? And there was a thing you bolted onto the piano somehow. There was another one called the Piano Mate that made very strange noises if you didn't bolt it onto the piano. It just kind of made a kind of whining, whining sort of sound. It made everything sound a little electronic. And Rolf Harris championed the stylophone, and eventually Dubrec. Oh, I think we're a French or Belgian firm, but although they're their offices, their factory was somewhere like Mill Hill or somewhere, or Cricklewood. That's where you ordered it from. And David Bowie pioneered one of these, and I got a much bigger one years later that had two styluses and had a reiteration effect. It went... And I used this. It was Rod Argent used one in Argent. But they were just ever so slightly before synthesizers became popular. It could have been an Elvis track. I was just thinking, when I heard the song just now and I listened to it in context, I mean, it could easily have been a Del Shannon song with slightly kookier lyrics. Yeah. It had everything about it. I thought Del Shannon could have sung this. It was nearly Runaway or something like that. Yeah, Runaway. Because yeah, Runaway also has, by Del Shannon, also has that strange one-fingered electronic organ on it that could be a stylophone. So they have that in common. That's the thing about the 60s. Everyone says, oh, the 60s, they were the good old days. We want to get that. The people in the 60s were, to a man, futurists. They were using absolutely the best things they could get. You know, from Ron Grainer's electronic workshop, or the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, which was a fantastic institution. They were futurists. There was bits of Stockhausen in there. And the Beatles used everything at their disposal and all George Martin's considerable armoury of effects, which he built up over working with the Goons, to get these amazing effects. And yet, people have never bettered it, so people these days are still trying to get back to what they were doing. But you must remember that the people in the 60s were futurists. Well, Ron Grainer, you know, with the Doctor Who theme, that's a good... Because there's loads of kind of... on that. That was one of the kookiest things you noticed. And then he's used an oscillator of some sort, a ring modulator, because it's kind of... And then he's using some kind of treated guitar that's going... And then it's... And all the time there's something going... when you consider this was all before psychedelia, somebody must have been, you know, at the metal polish, I reckon. That was the Joe Meek produced Telstar by the Tornadoes. Just probably up there with my favourite, definitely my favourite 20, possibly my favourite 10 records. Oddly enough, one of Margaret Thatcher's favourite records. Did you know that? She's very rarely drawn on music, but she admits always to liking that one, occasionally to liking How Much Is That Doggy in the Window, and every so often, if pushed, When a Man Loves a Woman by Percy Sledge, which I think, in at least two cases, exhibits extraordinarily good taste for a woman that I didn't necessarily agree with, to put it mildly. But this is a sensational record. I listen to it again and again and wonder, because he worked out of basically a flat above a greengrocer's in the Holloway Road. And in a Python-esque tragedy, he actually blew away his landlady with a shotgun because he'd got in a fit of pique. He was a son of the Forest of Dean, and I think he was a kind of genius. I mean, he didn't just produce Telstar, but he had real visions for the future, and Captain Sensible once played me his concept album, I Hear a New World, which is all set on the moon. I mean, it's very difficult. It would take too long to explain here, but that's very strange. But Telstar is the peak of it all, surely. There's a really transcendent bit where the guitars kind of soar in. It's like, you know, six Hank Marvins, you know, pushed into the space age. I mean, I loved the Shadows, but the guitars do sound great there. I think there were six Tornadoes, and they were kind of Joe Meek's house band when he wasn't busy arguing with them, not paying them, sacking them, or getting into rows with them. And I think also probably that was Clem Cattini on drums. And he was, you know, just, I think he's still about, you know, a great, great British, early Brit rock drummer. This is a wonderful record. Everything about it is optimistic. I could only have been 7 or 8 when it was a hit. And again, it was one of those records that really captured the imagination of the British public, coming as it did in the, you know, still pretty austere winter of 1962, pre-Beatles. You know, it was... you know, about half past Elvis and only 10 to Beatles, you know. So it was a bit of a thin time. And there was this great record in the charts. Simply everybody liked it, and it was there for weeks and weeks. I think something of a maverick talent that pretty much ran his own affairs, because the music industry found him rather difficult to tie down or to deal with. There's this guy making these great hit records, but I don't think they could really tie him down. George Martin at that time would have been an old-fashioned recording studio manager. He was making comedy records at that time. He would have been making records with Bernard Cribbins, The Goons, Peter Sellers and Sophia Loren. He had his work cut out, his hands full, making records with effects and comedy records and records with actors. And he I'd be very surprised if he wasn't keeping a weather eye on it. But as to whether he would have needed to be influenced, I mean, George Martin is a formidable intellect for both musically and in terms of recording technology. Talent is isn't just the ability to do. Talent is the ability to realise what you do. And his some flaw in his character, some kind of problem there, you know, some kind of madness or neurosis or whatever it was, stopped him advancing himself maybe to a state where he should have been. His refusal to deal with the mainstream industry. And this, actually, that's something I can quite understand. I mean, I've been told off myself for people saying, you could have done so and so. And I had one guy said, you've never made a record without a bloody mistake in it. And, you know, I've been told off. And I think, you know, in retrospect, it's right. You know, you hang out to get your own way. You're either on the bus or you're off the bus.
Is it to be admired, though? Because, I mean, I think perhaps...
I'm beginning to think not, because David Bowie, you know, David Bowie has a lot more money than I do. You know, and I'm thinking, well, David Bowie's an example who went around being, okay, then, all right, then I'll do that then, shall I? Whereas I'm, and Joe Meek, I'm somewhere between Joe Meek and David Bowie. I'm not saying I have the talent of either. I'm just saying that, that my attitude is I won't do what I'm told. On the other hand, I haven't yet blown my landlady away. Let me put my arms around your head. Gee, it's hot, let's go to bed. Don't forget to turn on the light. Don't laugh, babe, it'll be alright. Pour me out another phone. I'll ring and see if your friends are home. Perhaps the strange ones in the dome can lend us a book. We can meet up alone and try to get it on like once before. When people stared in Jagger's eyes and scorn, like the video films we saw. His name was always funny, and the shrug and ask to stay. She'd sigh like Twig the Wonder Kid and turn her face away. She's uncertain if she likes him, but she knows she really loves him. It's a crash course for the ravers. It's a driving Saturday. Enough to keep formation mid this fallout saturation, cursing at the astronet that stands in steel by his cabinet. He's crashing out with Sylvia, Euro supply for aging men, with snorting head he gazes to the shore. Once it rains, the sea rage no more, like the video films he saw. His name was always Buddy, as the broken ass of his name. And she'd sigh like Twig the Wonder Kid and turn her face away. She's uncertain if she likes him, but she knows she really loves him. It's a crash. Drive-In Saturday by David Bowie, from Summer of 73, as I remember, and from the Aladdin Sane album after he killed Ziggy Stardust. And I think probably from his most chemically enhanced, I would guess, But it certainly didn't disable him at that point or make his work any more pallid. That's a really exciting, futuristic track. And if the lyrics are gobbledygook, they're very great-sounding, very highly singable gobbledygook. Years ago, in the days before tribute bands, a young friend of mine, who was younger than me anyway, decided he wanted to go and do Ziggy Stardust, the entire opera in its entirety. Almost, like, this wasn't a tribute band, this was an ensemble of musicians called Moon Age Productions, who decided they would get seminal rock works and perform them in their entirety. However, Ziggy Stardust itself is only about 40 minutes, so it's not a full programme. So they sandwiched it between chunks of Hunky Dory and bits of Aladdin Sane, the album before it and the album after it, and then bunged Space Oddity in there. So you had an entire Bowie show, but we were so strict on ourselves, it had to be got exactly right. And when I was called upon to do it, I was saying, well, do you think we could do, we've done Hawkwind Space Ritual, which is one thing, now we want to do Ziggy Stardust. And I looked at it like an old builder, took a couple of steps back and went, ooh, you know, you're going to need two really good electric guitarists, one good 12-string player. You're going to need a concert-standard piano player and a concert-standard piano. And you're going to need a pretty nifty synth player. And you're going to need a great drummer. And all these people are going to have to double with vocals because Bowie was so good. I mean, absolutely brilliant. You know, if he's got this legend around him and this mystique, he thoroughly deserves it. He's... you know, an astonishing talent it was that time. Certainly that was, I think, Bowie at his peak. But even now, he has the capacity to surprise. I'm not one of these people who goes writing guys off, but it was like Paul McCartney said after the Beatles had broken up, and people said, he said, look, we did the Beatles. In 6 years, we did the Beatles, and we went from Please Please Me, and we went right up to Abbey Road. And he said, and now people are cross because we won't do it again. David Bowie has done enough. If he'd only done Hunky Dory, Aladdin Sane and Ziggy Stardust, it would have been better than most people have in an entire career. But to do that block of three albums, that was pretty good. And also very futuristic. I think he had the future nailed. He did it very well. It's still utterly listenable to now. It was a lot more futuristic than what we've got now. It looked forward. It looked into, you know, what sounds might we have in the future? They tried to be the future. No one does that anymore. When you listen to modern artists, especially the really big bands, your Coldheads and your Radio Plays and Keens and all that, they all seem to be very nice, well-behaved grammar school boys. And... doing rather self-pitying songs, you know, saying, oh, I'm sorry I'm so crap, I'll really try harder in this relationship, and or my last relationship was really terrible and so awful things happened to me and now I just kind of feel empty. And then, you know, kind of, there's quite a lot of whining self-pity. And they've all got a five-year plan. You can see they've signed the bank accounts up and they've invested sensibly and ethically. Mm. The changes have been so diverse. It's like the first of all, like a nuclear explosion, it went up. That was fine when it was going up. But then it hit the ceiling and went out and spread into all areas of our lives. That's what the super industrial revolution has done. And I think people are still coping with that. So they kind of, oh, here's a new idea, and they won't stick with one thing. And some people have just got running scared of it and thought, well, can we just have drums and guitars and pianos and go organic until it all settles down again? Because nobody knows what the next sound's going to be. And I remember in the 80s, I was working with someone and we did have a nice studio. We had a nice studio in West End and we had access to all the latest keyboards if we wanted them. And we used them. With the result that you can listen to that record where that most came to the fore. And we made a record that was made in 1987, and thanks to using the technology at the time, you can just point to it and it says, this is 1987, because that's a Roland D50, and that's a so-and-so-and-so-and-so, and there's a guitar effect that you don't get anymore because it's become untrendy. And it's... I won't name the album or the artist, but I was one of them, but... you know, I think it was the death of a career, really. That the death of a or the death of a, it was an album that I don't really like. Because I can hear exactly when it was made, and I'll never make that mistake again. If you go and get look at somebody's stereo, if you go and look at, if you see a Hitachi Music Centre with a cassette deck, can you remember how futuristic they looked in 1975? Wow, he's got a Hitachi Music Centre, and what they look like now, they're sort of junk shop stuff. You'd buy one to play to use as a bad taste 70s party for tenor, and then you'd junk it again.
Lots of flashing lights.
In fact, Hitachi was really good and very highly listenable gear. It just looked a bit horrible. And then in the 80s, it got even worse. Everything went kind of square and black. And then in the 90s, it all went ergonomic and kind of round. In fact, I can see one in the room now, a 90s-looking thing.
Yeah.
And you've got to be really careful about all this design stuff. In fact, I think I preferred it when you... Oh, God, I'm just an old git. But I preferred it when you had a... Just, what was wrong with just bass and treble? And not only that, but most people are pig stupid, I mean, when it comes to technology. And I include myself in that pantheon of the not very great. With tone, you think, right, well, this one makes it woofy and this bit makes it toppy and cuts your ears off, so leave it in the middle somewhere and we'll all be all right. And people have been baffled with so much choice. I mean, I remember I barely found out what a stereo graphic equaliser did. Then, lo and behold, my girlfriend appeared home with something that, at the time, appeared home with something that a salesman had sold her with a 10-band graphic EQ on it. And I thought, she doesn't even know how to switch it on. She's certainly not going to be able to manage that because I don't know how to manage. I don't know how to manage a graphic EQ. In fact, she roughly learned what to do with it by just pulling the knobs. She didn't do it in any kind of thing. Oh, I'll have a slope there because that's the top frequency. I'll put that at the top and I'll take the middle out of that and I'll scoop the middle. Me, for all my little bit of knowledge, is a dangerous thing. I got no better results than her. In fact, later on they brought out a Bonehead option. It had loads of presets. You just pressed, you know, this one's for the car, this one's for the cinema. No, you just press these and I leave it at that. Anyway, finally we had the graphic equalisers and basically... I don't know, my partner and everyone I knew suddenly had studio technology in a small degree at the fingertips, which sounded nothing like the early recordings such as this.
Baby upon their knees, I
Henry Burr, When I Leave the World Behind. Giant clock in the desert which would run for 10,000 years. This would have been about 1996-7, but Giant Clock, which I called the Ozymandias clock anyway, that wasn't its name, but I was reminded of the Shelley poem where he found these, the trunk and the vast and legs in the desert. And the idea was this giant clock would tick once a day and move its hands once a year, chiming every 100 years. So I wrote a futuristic poem about it. The first 1,000 years or so were harder to portray. The clock would move its hands each year and tick just once a day. It chimed its first millennium, one red and gold-leaf desert dawn, as rusted derricks, armoured cars and tanks uncovered by the wind lay useless, their own monument to centuries long out of mind. Above the desert, shooting stars still littered up the Milky Way. Rich lovers from a private plane took photographs and drank champagne, made love upon the scorpion sand, grew old and never came again. Once every 20 years it rained, then flowers sprang up for a day, and as the sands were washed away, numberless craft took to the sky, whose occupants gazed down to see an ancient caravanserai, its faded Pepsi-Cola sign and petrol pumps millennia dry. Later, a psychic railway ran, disgorging tourists every night. Pale ghosts of men stared at its face, then glided off in single file, while silent in the moonlight there, emaciated desert dogs, ears down and cringing at the sight, slunk out into the desert night. The clock still moved its hands each year, and ticked just once a day. The first 1,000 years or so were harder to portray. The first communication was of course Morse code, and when Henry Morse tapped a message out, he tapped out the message, "What hath God wrought?" Another thing about Morse, and this is an amazing story, in case it doesn't come across in the poem, is the dot, 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 dash, which is the letter V, is also the wartime sign for victory. But it was also the same meter as Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, written some time before, so it went duh-duh-duh-duh. Another thing my dad said is the people who knew Morse and who tapped it out incredibly quickly would often recognise each other's style. They'd without being told who was transmitting the message. This is a brief history of Morse. Dots and dashes did it in the films. And way out in the woolly west, awaiting freight from Santa Fe, a marshal in the midday sun stands apprehensive with a gun as sagebrush miles along the track. The buzzards, squatting on the poles, hear signals whisper down the wires, past cactus, cow skulls, gopher holes, where tumbleweed goes rolling by and three bad hombres wait to die. Dots and dashes did it down the line when Mr. Morse tapped out his test. What hath God wrought? The sentence stayed unanswered by the snoozing past until the future spoke at last, and wagons came, and men, and mines, then motor cars and longer lines spread out across the yawning land till progress had the upper hand. Dots and dashes did it later on, in radio blips from storm-tossed ships, whenever wind and wave kicked up, and hapless vessels in distress, their flares gone up, gone down, gone out, still sent a desperate SOS, the universal rescue shout. The dots and dashes did it, for so long. It's odd to think they won't be there, their crotchet quavers in the air. Dot, 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 dash, the letter V, the wartime sign for victory, was Beethoven's Fifth Symphony and Samuel Morse's Rhapsody, the tune still buried where he hid it. Did it, did it, did it, did it. Autobahn by Kraftwerk, or Autobahn by Kraftwerk. Kraftwerk were, of course, in that bracket. They were the first, what was called by British lovers of the genre, krautrock. Krautrock or electronica. In fact, many of us middle-class sort of hairy kids have been listening to Amon Duel 2 and bands such as this. So we've been listening, and Can. The more intellectual of us listen to Can, one of whose members actually trained under John Cage, I think, was taught by John Cage. So these were serious chrome domes, you know, the guys in Can. And gradually the kraut rock bands, the more esoteric ones, like Guru, yeah, Amon Duel 2, Kraftwerk, Klaus Schultz, Klaus Dinger, I think. There were lots of electronic people mucking about, and some of the titles are very good, like Amon Duel 2 had one called Dehypnotized Toothpaste. But the one that really broke in this country about 74, 75 was this track by Kraftwerk called Fun, Fun, Fun on the Autobahn. They all had names like Florian. They looked like shop mannequins, and the groundbreaking thing about them was they all just played synthesizers. There wasn't a drum kit or a guitar in sight, and it was something that the Germans were very, very good at and became known as krautrock. Kraut is, of course, a German word meaning, I think, cabbage. So it's not really racist or insulting, and of course most adherents of krautrock call it that, and they love it. You know, it's a big deal. But I remember it. I can't remember what it sounded like on drugs, because I wasn't one of the people I probably wasn't taking drugs when that became popular. It must have been pretty good, though. It must have been fun. I remember I saw lots of sort of long-haired people in greatcoats clutching their little German krautrock albums around with them, you know. I assumed it must sound pretty... I just thought it was an interesting sound. And it was the beginning of the movement that ran parallel with punk, of course. Brit electropop. Our boys got hold of it. And they weren't London boys. They were nearly all provincials. People like Depeche Mode came from places like Basildon, and the Human League from Sheffield. So disparaged by in the lyrics of My Perfect Cousin by the Undertones, you know. The synthesizer boys, they had short hair and they wore smart little casual clothes and they had these little Yamaha PS15s or whatever they're called, you know, or Casios. They went beep, 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 beep. And once, in my DIY days, I wanted to find out how to make this sound, because it got to a point where electropop was becoming so influential that producers were starting to make real drums sound like electro drums. So, and I found one way of doing it on a real budget, since I had no money in the late 70s, was to hang a sheet of silver foil on a bit of string with a, and then get me mum's plant spray gun on a fine jet, right, and squirt it. Now, the sound of the water hitting the sheet of silver foil hung out on clothes peg makes a kind of sound. So having got a bass drum beat by hitting the floorboard near the hearth with the hearth rug on and muting it with a, so you've got this kind of boomp, 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 boomp. I now put the headphones on, got the water gun ready with the silver foil, and every time I heard a boom, I'd follow it with that. So I got a whole track, a whole 3.5 minutes of
and that's
how I made my sort of first electronic drum kit, by using silver foil and water and my mum's plant spray.
You really were Joe Meepin.
Well, I just didn't have any money, and anyone who just has a burning creative spirit is going to do such things, you know. And because it became trendy, you thought, well, this is going to be much easier to imitate than a real drum kit. So that's what we did. So the spirit of Joe Meek arose again, yeah, nearly 20 years on.